You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello and welcome to this podcast, Advances in the Delayed Onset of Type 1 Diabetes, Strategies to Improve Awareness and Care for the Practicing Clinician, hosted by Med Learning Group. I'm Shpatim. I'll be the host of today's podcast. I'm very excited to be joined by Dr. Kimber Simmons, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the Barbara Davis Center for Diabetes at University of Colorado Anschutz in Aurora, Colorado, and by Kimberly Belts, a T1D patient advocate and mother of two children with T1D who will share her family's journey with type 1 diabetes. So Dr. Simmons and Kim, thank you so much for being here today.
Yes, of course. So Kim, it's really good to see you. And I'd just like to start off by talking about how type 1 diabetes became part of your family's life.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. Type 1 diabetes became part of our life almost 5 years ago when my 8-year-old daughter was diagnosed with diabetes at the age of 3. Unfortunately, she was in diabetic ketoacidosis at diagnosis, and we have lived with diabetes as part of our world ever since.
So tell me a little bit about how you noticed that she was sick and what that felt like and what that experience was like.
Yeah, so leading up to her being hospitalized, she was presenting with most of the common symptoms that you get with a kid with type 1. So she had extreme fatigue, she had a little bit of weight loss, she had extreme thirst, she was incredibly lethargic. Those symptoms were muddled with a really bad upper respiratory infection. It was also during the time of the beginning of the pandemic. And so I think that there were a lot of kind of mixed things that people were looking at the time. We had brought her into the pediatrician for her symptoms, and it wasn't dismissed, but I think that they were looking for other things. By the time that we brought her in for a second time, she was to the point that she was quite ill. And our pediatrician was the one to actually check her blood sugar. And it was over 500 at that point, which is when we were instructed to head down to the emergency room so she could get taken care of.
What was that experience like to go from having a healthy kid and then being told you have to go to the emergency room right away?
It was very traumatic and overwhelming. I don't even know if overwhelming is the right word because there were so many things happening so fast. There was also, I think, you know, it was figuring out how to manage this kid with diabetes that was healthy, or what we assumably thought was healthy the day before, on top of having this child that was really sick. And it was really scary all at the same time. And when you get a kid that all of a sudden flips a switch and has to manage insulin and blood sugar and all of these different things, you don't have time to learn all of that. It just has to happen all at once. And so before we were even allowed to leave the hospital, we had to basically have a crash course in how to inject insulin. What does that mean? What does that look like? How to carb count? How do those foods affect her? So that's why I say overwhelming might be even an understatement for what that felt like, leaving and having to go home and do that on a small child all on her own.
And then you decided to have another child. And when you had your second child, did you think about type 1 diabetes or the risk of type 1 diabetes in her at all?
So we pretty early on were contacted about sibling and relative screening, which was something I didn't know anything about. We were still very new in the type 1 diabetes world. But I think within a couple of weeks after Anna's diagnosis, we were contacted about the possibility of screening other family members. And Ellie at the time was only one, so she actually wasn't old enough to get screening. And so we waited until she was appropriate age, which was 2.5. And I had no reservations about getting her tested, mostly because I didn't want, if there was a possibility that she could have type 1, I never wanted her to go through what Anna had to go through and be so sick and have that trauma once again. And so once Ellie turned 2.5, myself, and my husband all got screened. Those results fortunately came back negative. And then we kind of sat and wondered for a little while if that was something that was ever going to change.
Yeah, and I think it's important to know that, you know, the age that you can get screened a lot of times depends, it has in the past depended on what the research studies can do. And so we know that a lot of kids who develop diabetes early in life have antibodies developed between the ages of 1 and 2. And so screening earlier than 2.5 actually makes sense from like a biologic standpoint. And so I'm glad there's opportunities to screen kids earlier as well. And so Ellie had a negative result, and you said you didn't really have any hesitations about screening her. Did your husband have any hesitation?
He did. We have different personalities that actually help balance our family dynamics quite well. And I'm very much a planner and very strategic with things. I like to know every bit of information. And his take on it was kind of more like, if we don't screen, then we won't know, right? It won't happen. And we were so early on in Anna's, journey with type 1 and figuring that out. I think he was more in the backseat saying, well, what if we just write it out, right? What are the chances that she could develop type 1 at such a low risk? But in fact, we found out that having a sibling with type 1 diabetes actually puts you in a little bit of a higher risk category. He was really supportive, even though we had maybe different reasons why one of us wanted to or didn't want to screen. But he was very supportive of our family knowing if she carried the antibodies for type 1 diabetes.
Yeah, I think it's hard to come from a history where you don't have diabetes in your family at all and your risk is less than 1%. And then to think about the increased risk that can happen once there's a sibling, which is closer to, 5% or maybe a little bit higher. And so I think that there's a lot of personal decisions and personal feelings that have to kind of be worked through to decide what the best thing is for your family. And so I'm glad that you were able to work through that together. So how long did you wait before testing Ellie again? And what made you decide to test Ellie again?
So we waited to rescreen her for 1.5 years, mostly because, once we got the results back from TrialNet, they're kind of like, she should be pretty okay, right? And I didn't really follow up many questions, and I just was like, oh, yes, things will probably be fine. And then we passed the anniversary date of Anna's diagnosis. So she was diagnosed in September of 2020, and Ellie was almost 4. And it just never goes out of your mind. And you always wonder, what if? Anna was diagnosed when she was 3.5. We screened Ellie at 2.5. We have no idea when Anna had antibodies present. And every time Ellie would be sick or every time I thought she was drinking too much water, I would poke her finger just to make sure it was fine. And then I remember bringing Anna in actually for an appointment to see you for just a yearly visit. And we had a really great conversation on kind of those exact things and when to screen and if we should rescreen and what we should be looking for. And so it was a pretty easy decision for me after that to just rescreen her. And why wouldn't I rescreen her every year just to make sure we weren't missing something that could so easily be tested?
And so then talk through when you screened Ellie that second time, how you were informed of her results and what that experience was like.
So the second time around, we rescreened with a different program that checked for more autoantibodies than she was originally rescreened for. And because it was through research program, it took a couple weeks for the results to get back. We got a phone call actually on Anna's 6th birthday. Ellie was 4 at the time. That Ellie had not only tested positive for one type 1 antibody, on that screening, she came up positive for all 4, which was definitely not easy news to take. It wasn't completely out of the blue. Obviously, we knew she was at risk, but it was not something we were expecting. So it definitely wasn't easy news. We, within a week's time frame, however, had her into the clinic to have her tested again to make sure that that result was actually what it said it was in that first test. We made sure she was safe. So we made sure at that point that she wasn't in urgent need of insulin, that, you know, we had a maybe relatively good idea of where she was at stage-wise. And then we have been followed ever since.
And so how did Ellie and Anna both do with the news about these antibodies? What did that look like for young kids?
So when I found out about Ellie's antibodies, Anna was with me, and I couldn't help but, you know, cry my eyes out because it was such an emotional piece of news to get. And Anna looked at me and she was so confused by my emotional reaction. And she asked if she could be the one to tell Ellie that she was going to have diabetes just like her, because in her mind, there's nothing wrong with having diabetes, and she lives her life to the fullest. And so having this other person, this sibling in her life that was going to be just like her, was the best news she could have ever got. And so it really helped ground me a little bit more and, you know, see the silver lining through it all, that, you know, these kids are, they're strong, they're amazing. I hope that it shows that Anna really does have a great life and she's so strong. But, you know, knowing as a parent how hard it is to, you know, over time live with this disease and manage this disease, you don't want that for, you know, for especially your child. And so when we got home, Anna walked right up to her, you know, 4-year-old sister and said, "Guess what? You're going to have diabetes just like me." And her response was, "Okay, you know, when?" So, you know, I think that was the more confusing part for Ellie, is that, you know, she was one when Anna was diagnosed. So she doesn't, I mean, Anna doesn't remember life without type one, and Ellie surely doesn't. And so, you know, to her, it was okay, whatever. I mean, it was, you know, very, you know, low emotional response, no big deal. And then I think the questions came later. I'm like, well, what does that mean? Like, when am I going to have diabetes? Do I get a pump? Do I get insulin? Like, that part was a little bit more, I think, and still is a little bit more confusing to her.
Yeah, you have such strong, amazing girls and have built such resilience in your family. So really great job with that. But I love that story. When Ellie tested positive for islet autoantibodies, then what were you told were kind of the next steps, and what did that look like?
So after she came back with her positive test, we were followed by two different teams, mostly because we screened with two different teams. And we were given a significant amount of information on what that looked like, you know, just moving forward in the future. You know, when you come from a backstory of having a kid diagnosed so abruptly and having to do all the things, this was a very different bit of information, because we still don't really have this exact timeline of when things are going to happen. But we were explained staging, what that looked like, how often we should monitor Ellie, when she should be wearing CGMs. We did follow through with an oral glucose tolerance test, because that was only the true way to stage her, to know that we were in stage one. And after that, it was truly just monitoring up until the point that she started to progress to stage two.
And what were the first signs that her glucose levels were changing, or that she was progressing from stage one to stage two?
So we picked it up on a CGM that I had her wear at home. And because in stage two, you're not likely to have any symptoms, the only way we would have picked up that shift was because we were monitoring her blood sugar so closely. And so it was actually over winter break. She was wearing a continuous glucose monitor. And because I'm so used to reading graphs from my older daughter, something just didn't look right. And she was spending a little bit more time higher and wasn't coming down into a soft landing quite as much. So that gave us some early cues that something was changing.
So when she changed, you came back in for evaluation and confirmed that she indeed was moving towards stage two of type 1 diabetes. And then at that time, what were you given as options for her care?
Yeah, so we came back in and did an oral glucose tolerance test to determine that she was in that stage two. And we, because of her age, were eligible to participate in the petite study for teplizumab for kids under the age of 8. Because she wasn't over the age of 8, we knew that she wouldn't be eligible to receive the drug. So we just were really fortunate that that was given an option. We didn't have to pursue that, but because of the encouragement from our team and the information we were given, we were extremely interested in doing anything we could to preserve her beta cells for as long as possible.
And what were your biggest reasons that you went ahead and did it, and then your biggest concerns and questions as you were making that decision?
So I think our number one reason why we went along with pursuing the teplizumab treatment was to keep Ellie from having to rely on insulin for as long as possible. Having a kid already living with type 1, even though she's amazing and she's strong and she's resilient, any day or any month or any year that you can live without the burden of type 1 diabetes is such valuable time. And any time that we were able to give that to her, even if it was just a few months, was worth it for our family. The things that we were most concerned about were just the side effects that we were given information on. I think that would be a common concern of any parent signing up for any type of trial or medication when you're not quite sure what's going to happen. In particularly with Ellie, because in her age group, the drug wasn't cleared yet because they were studying it. And so, you know, with the confidence in our team, the benefits outweighed the cons by so much that it was nothing to hinder our decision.
And so what did the side effects look like for Ellie? How did she do during the infusion?
So she had, I would say, pretty mild side effects when you look at the big picture of things. She had the most common side effects for little kids. She had a very mild rash that was not bothersome at all. She had some nausea and vomiting for just over 24 hours, which I think was probably her worst side effect. We were given the proper tools, the proper medications to really help mitigate that. You know, and I think just overall fatigue. She was pretty tired. You know, she was also on some other medications that would make her a little bit more sleepy. Afterwards, I think it probably realistically took her a few weeks to get back to normal energy level. She had a little bit of recurrence of some nausea and vomiting a few days after the treatment ended, but that was pretty much it. So I think as a whole, she tolerated it significantly well.
That sounds pretty consistent with what we've seen in other patients too, is nausea and headache. We say kind of mild flu-like symptoms. And then because we give those medications to try to decrease side effects like antihistamines, people are really tired. So it sounds like she had an experience that's pretty typical of most people, I think, getting the medication. Were you concerned about infection at all during that time, or how did that look for you?
Actually, not at all. She I feel like was so well taken care of with every step of the way. And because we were in the clinic and seeing providers every single day and there for so many hours, that actually never even crossed my mind.
So I think the lowered cells that fight infections is so temporary that usually when patients receive them every day, we can kind of talk through that. And by the end of their infusion, they're in a safe place most of the time. So I think that's good. So Ellie received this infusion a while ago now. What have you done since then to check on her diabetes?
Yeah. So we still monitor blood sugar. I try to be trusting in what everybody tells me and not overdo it. And so we stick to the every 3 months of CGMs. We do monthly finger pokes. We check a little bit more frequently when she's sick. We're just over a year out as of March of this year, and she's still doing fantastic. I do still get a little bit nervous every time I put a CGM on her, just because you never know, and try not to let it run our lives. And so I really try to trust the people that are looking over us and sticking with that plan.
And the data from the CGM, when you get that, is it something where it's blinded or do you see the numbers in real time?
So from the research team that sends us a CGM, it's blinded, which is better for me because then I'm not overanalyzing it. And then they send the data back to me. Because of my older daughter, we do have CGMs at home. And so I will occasionally put our own on her. I tend to do that more when she's sick, just so I don't have to poke her finger all that much. So clearly those are not blinded. But the ones through ASK are, which I think is just helpful for my own personal reasons too, so that I'm not overthinking it.
Do you have any tips for people that would be wearing CGMs where they're not blinded and they're seeing the numbers about how to manage all of that data?
Yeah, I think if you're not used to seeing it, definitely relying on your healthcare team. Even as someone that is really used to reading numbers, when Ellie was changing in her blood sugar, I still needed the expertise of the medical team to make sure I was seeing the right things. It's really easy to look at a type 1 diabetes graph on certain days and be able to tell that person has type 1. But kids that don't need insulin also have variable numbers. And so it can be quite confusing. And so that, trusting in the team that's looking over you to help navigate that process, I think is really valuable.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story. Is there anything you'd like to share with everyone before we move on?
Yeah, no, I'm just so grateful and happy that people are listening to this. It's such impactful information. It's made a huge difference in our lives to be able to have the opportunity to screen and the opportunity to be a part of such an amazing treatment. So I'm really grateful that people are taking time to listen to this and learn.
Thanks for being such an amazing mom and an amazing T1D advocate. The world's really lucky to have you and your family.
Thank you.
Thank you both for being here today, Kim. Thank you again for sharing all that you shared, and Dr. Simmons, for all the wonderful clinical pearls. It's great having you both here.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And thank you to all of you for joining us today. I encourage you to listen to prior episodes in this podcast series and for additional education, including in T1D, but other therapeutic areas as well. I invite you to visit our website at medlearninggroup.com. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group in support of improving patient care. MedLearning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, or ACCME, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, ACPE, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center, ANCC, to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. I'd also like to give a special thank you to our supporters, Sanofi US, who provided an educational grant for this activity. Thank you again, and have a great day.